sell those shares in Porsche, it is time for another Flat Chat. A special welcome this week to the many thousands of you who have had this as a bonus in the Autosport podcast channel. Welcome. If you enjoy what you are about to listen to over the next 60 or so minutes, then search for us on Flat Chat with Codders and like and subscribe. Smash that like button. There's various idiots on YouTube today. And as the latest issue of GP Racing magazine arrives on the newsstands, we look at why the Porsche Red Bull marriage is off before it was even on. A news story months in the making. Meanwhile, on the cover, we have Lewis Hamilton, written off by some pundits as a spent force who ought to retire. He says he's going to prove them all wrong, and Mercedes is counting on him to do just that. Joining me to ponder non-existent mergers and retirements are, live from Gateshead, it's Autosport's Matt Q.
Hello, Codders. Hopefully at this stage of my career, I'm nowhere near retirement. And as far as I'm aware, no mergers on the horizon. So just simple, unadulterated Matt Q for you.
Very good. Well, hopefully you're about to merge with a BMW 2002 in a week or so's time. Tittering at the other end of a line is Mark Gallagher. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you very much. Good to be here. I'm not going to mention retirement. This is getting dangerously close.
Some people never retire, though.
Yeah, well,
they?
I'm hoping not to completely retire, but once you hit the big 6-0, it starts to beckon.
We in our office, we have the joy of the ageless and boundlessly enthusiastic Tony Tobias, who various sales related to the Autosport International show. And I'm not actually quite sure how old Tony is, but he's nowhere near contemplating retirement. And he's so enthusiastic constantly.
We had just had the funeral of someone who kept going well into her 90s and worked right up until 2 days before, you know, mortality called.
Indeed. You came up with, I suppose, some people might say a massively obvious stat, but one I actually hadn't considered on the Twitter the other day, which was that only one Formula One world champion kind of completed their entire record before she was the reigning monarch, which just that sort of underlines that amazingly long run.
Yeah, that tweet took me about 3 days to compile because every previous version of it begged the question. Someone was going to go, but Fangio 51, and so I had to come up with their entire world championship record completed under Queen Elizabeth. So so Nina Farina, and that was it. But it actually, you know, it kind of makes you think, you know, that it was a kind of good perspective. I wonder, was she an Autosport subscriber for the entire time?
I'm not sure that Buck House was on the free list.
Are you sure?
No.
Well, I mean, they went to the first Grand Prix, didn't they? I mean, she didn't go to the first. It was her sister and her parents. But
It's a sort of a popular misconception that's grown up because of a misreading of the caption of the images, because it says King George the let me get my Georges right. King George the Sixth. Yeah. King George the Sixth and Queen Elizabeth appear at the inaugural World Championship Grand Prix at Silverstone in 1950. Of course, that Queen Elizabeth, more latterly known to us as the Queen Mother, who left us 20 years ago. Queen Elizabeth II, as she was not yet then, was pregnant and definitely not going to be attending motor racing events with loud cars.
I didn't realize you were the Motorsport Network's royal correspondent as well as everything.
The Nicholas Witchell.
Just call me Nicholas Witchell.
I promise never to call you Nicholas Witchell, Codders.
Let's revert back, in the words of a former colleague, to the actual subject. let's try and unpack the Porsche madness, which happened just before this issue of GP Racing went to the printers. Fortunately not as we were hitting Apple P, unlike last month's seismic news. What a strange thing this was. This was supposed to be not just an engine supply deal, but a partial acquisition of Red Bull Racing. And the due diligence had been done, all the legal boxes ticked, and it was just a question of when the 2026 engine regs were finalised that they would then ta-da it, as various irritating PR types say, using a sort of a, not just a noun as a verb, but a ridiculous noise as a verb. Unfortunately, those engine regs were delayed and second thoughts set in. So, Mark, you've been in the engine trade. You've had dealings with corporates. Surely it's never a good idea to give people too long to mull the consequences of a deal. Buyer's stroke seller's remorse can set in and scupper it.
It's interesting when you look at the fact that it was all looking to, like, was moving in the right direction, and then all of a sudden there was that gap, and then it kind of fell apart. But actually, it kind of feels that maybe both parties have had a near miss there, which they may well come to appreciate, because quite often there's a haste to getting deals done, and then you sign up to everything, and then you find out afterwards that it wasn't quite the way that you wanted it to be. And I was kind of really thinking about the fact that, you know, it was when BMW and Williams did their deal, and that looked on paper like it was going to be just going to be a great partnership, and it began to fall apart, and it began to fall apart because of power play between Munich and Grove, and in the end, BMW they were off and over to Sauber to do their deal over there. And I think the prospect of Porsche and Red Bull going the same way, where, you know, you could two heavyweights come in together and it's unable to find a structure that works for both of them. Porsche putting their brand into Formula One, it's such a massive statement. They don't really want to be playing second fiddle to Red Bull. And then equally, Red Bull they don't need Porsche. I mean, this is the thing which really became evident, I suppose, was that it's a nice, if it's a deal that can be done, it would be great. And obviously there's lots of benefits to that, but Red Bull don't need the money. I mean, that's the thing. The Red Bull Racing don't need the money. I'm sure they'd have welcomed it. You know, it's more profitability and, of course, great potential there in terms of the two, dare I mention the brand word, the two brands working together, Red Bull and Porsche. You could imagine they could start doing a whole bunch of things together.
What, there'd be synergies.
A lot of synergy. Ding. Huge amount of synergy. Yeah. Are we going to see how many times you can get the word synergy into the podcast? Helmut Marko and Christian Horner could not be more relaxed about the fact that this deal has not moved forward. They're completely relaxed about it. There is no sense that Red Bull were in the last chance saloon trying to do a deal with Porsche because, you know, what, Helmut's 79, Dietrich Mateschitz 78. I mean, it was, some people thought, oh, well, this will be like the stepping stone, Red Bull into Porsche. Porsche will buy the team or buy half the team and then take it over. And actually, the opposite has proven to be the case. Red Bull are in no rush to go anywhere. They've got their powertrain division. They have a high degree of confidence over that. Helmut Marko seems to think that they have at least one manufacturer, and I don't think it'll take a rocket scientist to work out who that is. So there's at least one manufacturer interested in working with them from 2026 onwards anyway. Had they signed a deal 2 months ago or whenever it was that the original press release was written, I think that might have well stored up a major problem for the future. So they've gone their separate ways. And the really interesting thing is that it's now begging the question, what do Porsche do? You know, does their entry in Formula One now diminish to the point where they don't come into the sport? And it's extraordinary to think that Red Bull has such power and confidence in itself that it can turn down this giant German, you know, performance car manufacturer, one that has, you know, it's got an IPO, it's got a float on the stock exchange, you know, many tens of billions, 70 odd billion of value for the company. But Red Bull don't need to hand over control to that. And I think, you know, this is where that detail that perhaps they then got to think about through July and into August became so important. Some people are seeing it as a power play by Christian Horner. I certainly don't see it that way. I think, you know, Christian, there's a very flat structure at Red Bull. There's Christian, there's Dietrich, there's Helmut Marko. They're all pretty closely aligned. I had the opportunity to chat to Helmut and Christian in Monza. I mean, they're still thick as thieves, and they want to make sure that they have a plan that they feel entirely comfortable with. And I think Christian's point that, you know, we're in a good place at Red Bull Racing at the moment, and we don't need to destabilize what we've got in terms of a structure. I think that is a sincere point that he has. One final thing I'll say about the Williams BMW thing, which has always made me chuckle, was that at one point in the Williams BMW relationship, there was a whole discussion about the strength of British engineering versus, you know, BMW's engineering in Munich and the way that those two work together. And Frank Williams arranged for a friend of his, Rob Lamplew, to fly over the factory of his Spitfire and do a victory roll which prompted the BMW executives to say, wow, what was that? And Frank said, that's British engineering, which was a rather pointed way of making his point, really. So, yeah, so, it you can imagine, particularly with the strength of personalities that, with Christian, with Helmut, with Dietrich, you get to 2027 or 2028 and there's discussions about drivers and structure and what's going on, and Porsche is trying to call the shots, and it could go south really, really quickly. So I see it as a sign of great strength for Red Bull, and Porsche now have some big decisions to make. And quite honestly, if they had made a decision to come into Formula One and now don't come into Formula One, someone hasn't done their homework very well.
I remember years and years ago, on the topic of owners stroke sponsors trying to call the shots, the schism between Sauber and Red Bull came about because Peter Sauber wanted to have Kimi Raikkonen. Dietrich Mateschitz said, "Uno, you're not. You're going to have Enrique Bernaldi." And now Peter Sauber must be very pleased that he won that particular argument, even though it came at the cost of losing Red Bull sponsorship.
I have to tell you that Dr. Helmut Marko told me that story, and he said it was him who fell out with Peter Sauber. He said, "I was the one who wanted Enrico Bernaldi to drive for the team," and he said, "and Peter wanted Kimi, and we fell out and we parted company, and that was it." I didn't really understand the punchline to him telling me that story, because I said, "So basically, you took a massively wrong turn." but he seemed to think it was a good example of his prowess in negotiating, and the fact that ultimately he'll do what he wants to do with including taking the Red Bull money away from Sauber in those days. So Helmut's nothing if not confident about his own position, even if his own position is wrong.
Oh, indeed, he's very forthright. Now, Matt, you wrote, you are now the custodian of our back page column, and you have opinions on car manufacturers in Formula One. This month's column, basically, I think the upshot is, I hope this isn't going to invoke any spoilers, but car manufacturers looking to get involved in Formula One need to face a fundamental truth, and that fundamental truth is that they cannot all win, can they? So could that be something that was playing across Porsche's mind?
In this specific case, probably less so. I think with Porsche, you expect to come in and win. I think where it's broken down is, I know this is obviously GP Racing magazine, but if you'll allow me a little sports car aside for a moment, just to put things in context, is that the
Let me just get my hourglass on, and you have no more than 90 seconds to talk about sports
right,
cars.
Done. But it comes back to, I think of the last era sports cars, LMP1 Racing, the Porsche 919 was the standard bearer. Came in, won Le Mans three times, I believe, and the World Endurance Championship to go with that. That nearly didn't come about at all because Porsche was so hands-on at it. It took the bosses of that race engineering program go, no, let us be kept to one side as like a after-hour skunk works program, and you write us the checks and we will win Le Mans for you with your badges, your name, and that's it, done. We are Porsche, but you cannot be interventionist. I think that's where this deal is falling apart, is because, you know, this wasn't going to be a Tag Heuer Porsche engine this time around, or you know, how Red Bull have run in the past with Aston Martin logos on the wing. Porsche wanted to instill people as well as write checks. And then that means you take Red Bull, which is, as Mark said, it's winning now. It's the best Formula One team at present. So it's risk destabilizing that. And not only do you risk losing that, you also risk then, as a sort of more independent body, although it's a massive employer, it's still lithe and fleet of foot. If you then have to go through chain of command at Porsche, you lose that and you can be less responsive, which is what Red Bull has been all the way throughout its career. So I think you have That case study of why Porsche was successful with the 919, and why you would have thought, you know, the CEO who's been there over that time span would sort of have brought that lesson to the way they're going to approach Formula One. Apparently not. It's interesting, actually, that the same person I've spoken to watched the Audi press conference at Spa, and we're a little bit worried by that, because you said, when you come in, okay, Audi wants to have a high profile announcement, but when you've got a chief technical officer and the CEO, they're two high profile people in suits who are already sort of fronting this organization, this entry. He said that's a bit worry. It's already corporate. And the fact that it's like the pre-existing chief technical officer running the F1 show, run ex-F1 head. They said those would raise a couple of alarm bells. But to bring it back to my column, yeah, I think, you know, having covered Formula E in a previous life during... I came in when it was good and left when it was bad, and I'm not taking full responsibility for all the German manufacturers leaving, but they left because the technology wasn't relevant. That, you know, you don't develop batteries, and that's what everyone is concerned about when an electric motor is already 98% efficient or whatever it is. Formula One's not in that place right now. We're actually, you know, a really interesting place where, despite the push towards electrification, its hybrid elements are seen as a future, or certainly that the commercial aspects of Drive to Survive and the boon and the big audience is enough to offset that. So whether that, you know, you have another manufacturer coming in and Porsche or Audi and they win, and then that knocks the example I cite in my column is Alpine, whether that knocks them lower down. And yes, you know, manufacturers come and go in motorsport, that line's always been trotted out. And there doesn't necessarily have to be a fault with the championship for those manufacturers to come and go like there is in Formula E. Could just be the recession or people get bored of not winning. But perhaps actually, you know, the current success of Formula One is enough to have everyone stay in, that Alpine can or the Renault group can continue to fund Alpine, even though the name doesn't really carry much weight, I don't think, Alpine, but use F1 as a platform to sort of promote your brand. Perhaps now it's so commercially successful that it doesn't matter if you're not winning, but I would look at it. What's, you know, they say in general, like sort of, you know, two's company, three's a crowd. F1, it's a bit bigger than that in terms of manufacturers, but if Honda's coming back in, so someone's got to lose. And when you're writing, even in the age of cost caps, you know, checks for 250 million minus Fernando Alonso's salary or whatever, that's a lot of money to be losing to come, you know, 14th and 15th, which is what having more manufacturers that entails. It shuffles everyone down. So it's a roundabout way of saying Formula One's in a very good place at the minute. If two manufacturers go, it's still in a very good place. And then beyond that, I think if it's 3-4, then you'd have to say something's fundamentally wrong. But I don't think we're at that place yet.
Do you know, I might have to join you in the sports car anecdote memory go round, because you've prompted a memory, Matt, a long, dim and distant memory of past. I'm going to say it's 1998 when I was but a stripling. The winter of 1998, I was invited along with a bunch of other automotive e-sportive journalists to Berlin, to where Audi were demonstrating their then new sports car with a run around the velodrome in Berlin. And they showed this car, which looked great from some angles, but it had clearly, and it emerged later, it hadn't actually been designed by a race car designer. It had been styled by people who designed road cars, and it had been styled to look a little bit like a hotted up Audi TT. And they ended up very, very late in the day realizing that they'd bitten off substantially more than they could chew by committing to this Le Mans program. They also had a car with a roof in sort of semi-parallel development. So they called in Tony Southgate, venerable designer, to sort of A, silk persificate the open top car, which was a basket case, and B, as a backup plan in the very few hours of the day and night left available to him when he wasn't busy silk persificating the open top car, he would oversee the design of a closed top car to be built somewhere in the wilds of Norfolk. And neither of those programs came to much. They ended up having to do a clean sheet design for 2000 and junk the whole thing and start again.
All of which kind of, you know, everything you're saying and Neil telling that story and also Matt, your point, it all kind of filters our thoughts through to the fact that car manufacturers aren't very good at doing motor racing a lot of the time. They like the look of it, the smell of it, what it could potentially do for them. But actually too often they go off half-cocked for whatever reason. You know, there's either not enough understanding about the scale of the challenge, and if there's any degree of kind of hubris or arrogance, you know, they quickly get found out because you come in against people who are doing it all the time, and you discover actually there's a reason why not everyone does this all the time. It's a fundamentally difficult thing to be good at. And I mean, I think one of the great things about Mercedes' achievement in the last decade is that Mercedes finally the penny finally dropped as to how a manufacturer should do Formula One, which is that you create a very entrepreneurial team, which is distinct from the parent company. And in their case, actually owned partly by Toto, and of course now owned also partly by Jim Ratcliffe from Ineos Group. You know, Daimler-Benz's involvement is only a third. Porsche may not have thought that through. I mean, if they bought a third of Red Bull, Porsche would have a place at the table, a place at the boardroom, a place at the meetings, but they wouldn't control the whole company. And Red Bull, you know, but obviously Porsche wanted more than that. And yes, when you've got four, five, six manufacturers involved, there's going to be one or two who do quite a lot of winning. There's going to be maybe a third who gets the odd win. And then there's going to be two or three who just don't get the victories. And maybe the numbers do stack up with the viewership and the audiences and whatever. But the problem is it still costs, particularly now that we have a budget cap, you're still spending the same amount as everyone else, but you're not winning. And so the return on investment is much more difficult to justify. And, you know, the point that you made about like the Audi launch, I also looked at the personalities involved and I thought, this is an interesting start. And, you know, if you look at Alpine, so you've got Laurent Rossi, who is chief executive of the Alpine car company, effectively running the F1 program, or the, you know, and doing a lot of the front facing piece on the F1 program, and that seems strange. And with the recent debacle over drivers, you kind of think, so there's a kind of an implication. You can't do Formula One as just part of your job. You know, it has to be absolute full on, huge commitment, and throw the kitchen sink at it if you'd have any, you know. Whatever people listening think of, you know, whether you're a Mercedes fan, you love Toto Wolff, or a Red Bull fan, you love Christian Horner, whether you don't like the competition or whatever, there's a reason why Christian Horner and Toto Wolff have dominated Formula One with their teams for the last dozen years. And that comes down to the degree of commitment that they have personally and the team behind them has to Formula One, and their shareholders have to. I mean, there's total commitment there. They leave no stone unturned. They're going to take no prisoners. They are absolutely committed to the task of winning. And I think everyone else, if there's compromises built in anywhere else, that they're not going to succeed. And not many car manufacturers will come in and do it on a no compromise basis of absolutely going for it. I do wonder what will happen to Porsche. The team that strikes me as being, it ought to be perfect to be bought in its entirety, is Williams, because the Williams family sold it to a private fund, a family fund, which is headed by Darlington. You know, they're not selling anything. It's not like they're a car manufacturer, an energy drinks company. They're not selling sports cars, whatever. They don't even have the diversified technologies business, particularly. You know, they've offloaded that. You know, if the people behind Darlington, if the family fund behind Darlington wants to make a real killing on their investment, now would be a good time to sell the whole thing to Porsche. And then Porsche would get what they want. You know, Jos Capito's, he's into, you know, 2 years as chief executive at Williams. Williams really, really need to start making progress. That is, if they have the ambition to become a winning team again and to ever challenge for the championship in the future. And we all know how long a road that is. I mean, and that's a kind of 4 to 5 year road. I mean, really, if any team was to be looking at 26 and saying, that's a chance for us to press a reset button, it's Williams, because that gives you 2023, 2024, 2025 to get everything right so that you hit the ground running with a potentially winning car in 2026. But it's interesting that despite, you know, the fact that Jost and FX, the chief technical officer, are ex-Volkswagen group, there's been no mention, at least publicly, of either an Audi or a Porsche tie-up. But for me, I kind of look at it and think that's the one that feels like it ought to be the next step for Porsche. But you know, they'd have to want to commit in the way that I just mentioned. It has to be all or nothing.
On that note, it's quite interesting because Audi, before they settled on jumping into bed with Sauber, they did their due diligence on Aston Martin and Williams. And obviously, they came out either second or third best. So they obviously know the flaws, or certainly the umbrella Volkswagen group knows the flaws with that setup, and now have to assess, because I think I'm right in saying the deadline to sign up for 2026 is the 15th of October. So as we record this, that's what, 3.5 weeks
it's
away.
Quick. Yeah. It's soon.
And then that 3.5 years to set up an F1 program, or you know, if Porsche still wants to revive this or have its own front its own engine partnership, that's a lot of work to do, because you know Williams would have to rip up that contract with the Mercedes powertrain if it was to jump into bed with Porsche, and they've said they want two different powertrains. It's not going to be a rebranded Audi one in the back of Williams. It's not a lot of work. But if I might just go back and after the coverage of the death of the Queen, the praise for the BBC has been widespread. So let me introduce an element of BBC balance to the podcast. And so I think Porsche had their own reservations about going into bed with Red Bull. I don't think it's a total one-way street. And that is that, you know, obviously they want to install someone alongside Horner and Marco, but I don't think it would have suited them what Zak Brown would call the optics. I don't think it would have suited that to have Marco blowing his valve about his own drivers and what he said in the past, Valtteri Bottas's pants overtaking. And there's that great one. I think it was when the hybrid era first came in, or maybe it was after 2017. Marco said, oh, Adrian knew he's castrated by these engine rules that kill the sport. I can imagine why Marco wouldn't want, or Porsche wouldn't want Marco going off and saying that. And then if Porsche, you know, the logical conclusion is that one day they want their halo German driver, how will they want still Marco calling shots on that front? I don't know. So I say it's, I can imagine, as you write in your leader for this month, Codders, part of it is that they had too long, I think, to think things through. It wasn't like an impulsive, you know, go with your heart. They've had time to introduce an element of head. So I think Porsche management and obviously the Volkswagen group is now led by the Porsche CEO. He has both roles at present. I think they'll have looked at a few things and thought, okay, this isn't going quite the way we want. If Porsche are going cold, do we really need to move heaven and earth to sort of get them back on side? Probably not.
Maybe they looked at Williams and thought, Doralton just sounds like a Netflix costume drama.
All I can say is I hope when I'm 79 like Dr. Marco that someone is worried about what I might do when I'm 83 in 2026. But anyway, he's still going strong.
I think the thing is that in Formula One, there are some people who say absolutely nothing of interest, and then there are other people who shoot from the hip. And it is the latter constituency that the media are drawn to. It used to be that if something happened at Mercedes, you'd go and find Niki Lauda because he would have an opinion on it, and he would say something opinionated about it before either Toto or their multilingual press attaché Bradley Lord had got the chance to slap a gagging order on him, and so he'd say something. And I think the basically going to Helmut Marko is route one when you need a controversial quote, and it's something that the Austrian media do, and then the other media pick up those quotes. Obviously it gets fed through the German, and his Austrian accent probably confuses a few syllables, and it comes out even more fiery than it was intended, because very often when something is translated, some of the nuance gets lost, doesn't it? So it's a difficult thing in the media landscape at the moment, where so much news is quote driven, and it's the actual words rather than the sense in which it's spoken. But I suppose we're digressing now, because you know, we as F1 media, we have to keep the news machine running 24/7, and Grand Prix only happen every few weeks, or every week if it's a triple header. Or you can look at what's published in other magazines. On this month, on the cover of GP Racing this month, we contemplate Lewis Hamilton, and not just the fascinating pink ensemble he wore for the cover shoot of a recent issue of Vanity Fair. He kind of looked like the second coming of Don Johnson in Miami Vice in that high-waisted short-sleeved garb. Fantastic. Only Lewis can carry that off. But, you know, it was a very interesting interview. And months ago, as it turned out, while the interviews for this Vanity Fair piece were happening, I approached our regular correspondent, Andrew Benson, and said, is it too early to drop several thousand metric gallons of cold water on the theory that Lewis is a spent force and about to retire. At the time, he said, well, actually, it's kind of a little bit tricky to work out because there's mixed messages coming from the Hamilton camp. But at the same time, the narrative that he's being absolutely tonked by George Russell is wrong. And this, you know, this was around the time of the Miami Grand Prix. We were having this conversation right about the time when the tabloid press were at fever pitch saying Lewis has had it. He should cash in his P45 now and take his private plane off somewhere and make way for someone else. So finally, I managed to persuade Andrew that he'd got enough data to write this analysis of where Lewis Hamilton is now. And he's come up with what I, not to bang my own drum as the man who commissioned him to write it, but I thought a really, really good story. Just has taken apart Lewis's season and analysed the early season wobble that's related to last season's controversy. It's deconstructed the whole business of whether he's firing on all cylinders. Clearly he is. And also we look at how Mercedes has now come to rely on his unique skill set to restore them to the front of the grid, because this is a team which is struggling with its car. And not only that, they are finding that they've lost correlation with all their tools. So what's now needed is a driver with Lewis's experience and speed to be able to feed back to them and say, no, this is working. That's not working. Let's try this. Let's do that. This is the way forward. And they're doing things like putting a floor on the car, which hasn't been tested in the wind tunnel, but relies on his backside to sign it off. And I think that is quite fascinating.
I wouldn't normally read a sentence out, but I love the point where Andrew talks about Lewis is a man whose worldview is one of perpetual struggle. It's what he feeds off and it's what motivates him. And I think that's so true, you know. And I've had the opportunity to work with him, and I mean, he will happily talk about what motivates him in life and how as a child, you know, he failed to face a lot of obstacles, you know, being bullied at school, and then, you know, some of the racism that he faced in karting and the aftermath of Abu Dhabi, and then Lewis going away, taking that winter off, coming off social media, which of course in itself then raised lots of questions. Why has he come off social media? Why is he not giving us a narrative? What is he thinking? Is he going to retire? All that kind of stuff. Then coming back only to discover that Mercedes-Benz have a car that's uncompetitive and got some fundamental problems. But actually, rather, he's not a quitter. You know, he's a fighter. He likes to come back and fight. And the team know the strengths that he has on that front. And you'd have to say, you know, they've done an admirable job considering where they were at the beginning of the year. They've, you know, operationally, they're kind of, their execution at race weekends is better than Ferrari. And only the other day I was, you know, somebody was asking me about, you know, Red Bull and the championship. And I said, actually, the thing that's fascinating to me is what happens for second place in the constructors. Because if Ferrari continued to trip up and God forbid have any more reliability issues, etc., I think George Russell and Lewis Hamilton will enjoy vanquishing them. And so there's actually a huge motivation there. And Toto, as I said earlier on, massively committed individual, and he knows it in Lewis. He has a fellow fighter. I think the George Russell comparison is really interesting. I was very struck by the performance differential. You know, Lewis out qualifying George, not by a huge amount in terms of races, the number of races where he's out qualified him, but the margin, you know, 57,000th of a second on average. I mean, it's not 0.2 or 0.3. 57,000th of a second is basically little to choose between them. It's incredibly impressive in terms of both Lewis and George, because as Andrew says in the article, you know, George is in the first flush of being with, you know, Mercedes and the enjoyment that he's getting out of that. You know, a bad Mercedes is a lot better than a good Williams. So he's, you know, he's enjoying every element of it. But I think it's a really interesting piece. I think, you know, the whole point about the discussion around Lewis is, you know, for me also, to some extent, we all have to take a step back and, you know, he is 37, and therefore, whatever we say about the future, no matter how motivated he is, no matter, you know, what there is to come, that there is that ticking clock. And one of the things about this year is, you know, I thought it was very admirable that Mercedes were admitting we don't quite know what the problem is. You know, they've been quite open about that. We're now recording this podcast end of, you know, end of September. Mercedes are well into next year's car. The question, the big question is, where are they with next year's car? Because if Red Bull carry the momentum from this year onwards, there's no reason to believe that they won't. You know, where, what happens when if Lewis gets on board the car next year and finds that he's going to be permanently, you know, battling for second and third again? That becomes, that ultimately that starts to become demoralizing at a point in his career where he really, really wants to be in a competitive car. So I think it's a long way from being over. I think he and Mercedes will continue to work hard. There seems to be quite a harmonious relationship, at least at the moment, between Lewis and George, which is incredibly important to Mercedes after their difficult experience with Lewis and Nico Rosberg. So at the moment, there's kind of still everything to play for. One final thing I'll say and then hand over to you, Matt. But as it got towards the end of this piece and I was reading about, you know, Lewis's other interests and the fact that he has always authentically maintained that the other interests are really important to him, interests outside of Formula One are really important to him because they actually give him a break from the pressure of F1 and he comes back into F1 refreshed. But, you know, I was reading the words at the end and thinking there's a slightly different tone. You know, he knows he doesn't have anything left to prove, and he doesn't have anything left to prove in Formula One in terms of speed and competitiveness and racecraft and everything else that goes with those 100 plus Grand Prix victories and 7 World Championship titles, bracket 8 if it wasn't for what happened in Abu Dhabi. But you have the sense that even he is aware that he's moving into the end game. You know, and it's a question of how long that end game then becomes. Is it a year? Is it 2 years? You know, is it the contract? Is Lewis going to do what his mentor Niki Lauda did and just turn up in the Toto's office one day and say, "I'm walking away. You know, I don't want to race this weekend." You know, will that be Lewis's exit? Will it be quite a dramatic exit? Because I don't think for Lewis the kind of petering out career will have any appeal. You know, I don't see Lewis doing what Damon Hill did, particularly the second half of 99, his final year in F1, which was a shame. You know, if once you make your mind up, you need to go. And so anyway, it's interesting to read that piece. And I thought Andrew did a great job of getting the balance right and the insight into the fact that there's a lot of mileage left in Lewis yet, but the end game is ultimately out there.
I sort of see that when Hamilton's out of F1, he's gone. He doesn't come back into the paddock, certainly not on TV. I feel he's then sort of becomes slightly intangible. At the minute, we as press, we hang on his every word. When he's outside of F1, does that change? Will his audience change? Where will he go to sort of get the attention to shine the light on the work he's doing? In the same way that I think one of the things Vettel has been grasping with as he has announced his retirement is, what's his audience when he leaves and is then behind closed doors with his family? Is having renewable technology powering your house and appearing on Question Time, is that enough for him to draw maximum attention and to get what he wants out of his environmental concerns? I wonder, is the same with Hamilton. Does his audience diminish? Do we, as people who like motorsport first and foremost, does our sort of tacit understanding and going along with his causes and whatever, does that diminish if he's not in F1 and right at the forefront? I wonder if that, you know, does MBS or the president of the FIA doesn't listen to him? Does the "we racers won" gestures happen quite so much if Lewis Hamilton isn't in that paddock? I don't think they do. And as he's maintained all the way through his career, he can bit an NBA game on the Friday night and put it on pole on the Saturday. So he can manage both simultaneously. So if he is given a car that can fight for, you know, wins, then I think he stays in F1 exactly, and avoids that decline, but for as long as possible to get maximum eyes. Also, let's not forget, he'll be getting a nice salary throughout that time, so maximum funds towards those projects. So I think that's a really interesting thing. And as he has seen Mercedes develop, okay, at Spa, they were off the boil. But the narrative around, or certainly what he's saying to the press, has changed so much. So in prep for this podcast, I was reminded of something he said in Monza, and I hope you don't mind, but I'm just going to read some direct speech from him that he said. And the narrative was around Daniel Ricciardo joining Mercedes as reserve driver to potentially replace him in 24 when his contract's up. And he said, the stories of retirement and what's stopping me. I feel healthier than I've ever felt. I focus a lot on that. I'm feeling fit. I love what I'm doing and I don't plan on stopping anytime soon. I'm sorry, Daniel, but no. I feel like I can race for quite a bit longer, so I'll potentially be steering towards that. That's as emphatic as Lewis Hamilton has been in the post-Abu Dhabi, I can't find motivation, I thought about walking away from sport, that he will be here for years to come. So I think, well, certainly a contract extension beyond this one. So I think that's a positive sign for him, keeping him in the championship. But to sort of go back to where I started, I just find it fascinating. What is his internal conflict between when is the right time to retire and do I have any risk? Yes, obviously we know he's, you know, welcome on any red carpet and can turn up to the Met Gala and buy a table. And still has that profile better than anyone else across social media, better than anyone else in the sport, not just in F1, in the entire sport. But is there any sort of concern that if I'm away, yes, I can still invest and yes, I can still work with business partners and whatever to achieve what I want to do with the foundation and Mission 44. But is the audience there? Can the impact be quite as great? And I find that really fascinating sort of dichotomy he might have.
Yeah, you're raising a really important point, which is that, I mean, let's be clear, Lewis has a massive fan base, and he's brought a new fan base to Formula One. What happens to that fan base when Lewis leaves F1? There's a question, you know. Lewis's fans are, you know, passionate about him. He's the first black driver in Formula One. This morning, before this podcast, I did was involved in a diversity and inclusion panel with an international company. And they were asking me about the impact that Lewis has had on Formula One in terms of, D&I. And I was saying, you know, really, it was probably 20 years ago that Formula One teams, you know, leadership levels, realized we need to get more women into this sport because we have a shortage of engineers, not enough women are doing engineering, we need to address that. So there's a kind of a real push towards gender diversity, you know, going back a couple of decades, F1 in schools, Formula Student, etc. But it's Lewis who then set the tone in terms of you know, being the first black driver and making everyone, let's face it, rethink the fact that when you walk down the paddock or the pit lane, there's all, you know, essentially no black people working in Formula One. Yes, there are people from ethnic minorities over the years and the drivers from lots of different countries around the world. But, you know, he has had such a profound impact on the sport. Now, I know the one thing he's absolutely passionate about is that when he retires as a driver and he leaves the sport, he doesn't want to go down in history as the only black driver there ever was in F1. So he's putting a huge effort into making sure that that does not happen. And I don't think, therefore, that I think when he retires from driving a racing car in Formula One, I think he will leave the sport in many areas. I think he will, but I think the one area where he will not leave the sport is on driving the diversity and inclusion piece. I think he and Toto Wolff have invested too much time, effort, and money in it. Mercedes have invested a huge amount of their sort of equity as a team in supporting Lewis's programs. Toto and Lewis have the Ignite program. They've invested £500,000 in grants to Motorsport UK and also the Royal Academy of Engineering, Royal Engineering Academy. So they've done a lot already, and I think that's going to keep on going. It'd be very interesting to see what happens, because Lewis could easily, if he wanted to, acquire a percentage of the Mercedes-Benz team. It only has to be a small involvement, but it means when he turns up at a race, he's not turning up as an ex-driver. He's turning up as a current shareholder of the team. You know, he could be on the board. He could be an advisor to the board. He could be, I mean, effectively, Lewis could move into the similar position that Niki Lauda had in terms of, you know, his interaction with the team, all that kind of thing. So he's very passionate about not being the only black driver. And I don't think he wants to I don't think he'll want to leave Formula One and just disappear off to America to get involved in film and music and fashion. I think film and music and fashion will definitely be part of what he goes on to do. But I think his diversity and inclusion work in F1, Matt, will, I mean, as you rightly point out, it's been such an important part of of what he's driven. And I think that will have to continue, because if he severed all links, that would be extraordinary, having invested the time and effort in the Hamilton Commission, in the Ignite program with Toto, equality and rights for all, be it gender, be it sex, be it race, whatever. I mean, he's been so pivotal on that. And you have to believe that, you know, if he can invest in sports teams in America, it's not too much of a leap of faith to imagine him sitting down with Toto over a coffee one day and saying, you know, what can we structure going forward? Because I don't want to turn my back on the sport. So it'll be interesting to see how it pans out.
I think he said as much, hasn't he, with the NFL investment. And also when, you know, I know there's some poking fun that he's Arsenal fan, but then investing in Chelsea. And I would also put that now with, you know, Jim Ratcliffe obviously making noise about Manchester United, if he ever was to buy it. I think Lewis Hamilton is involved there as well, because he can claim to be a fan or whatever, but it's not about that. He said openly that any investment, small or big, it's not about whether I can sit on the board and say we signed this striker or whatever. It's about what we can do for the community. So that, again, the way he's branching out, because he said time and time again, I don't care about records, I don't care about statistics. Obviously, the 8 world titles, I'm even clear of Schumacher, and not settle, but go a long way in that, you know, greatest of all time debate. That is obviously a huge motivating factor. But, you know, I think this he sees as a far greater legacy than his sporting achievements. So how that plays into retirement, and to bring it back round to sort of strictly what happens on track is what Mercedes can do next year. You know, there's a reason every video game, lots of movies start with you at the bottom, and by the end of it, you're a successful millionaire with all the flash cars and whatever, because it's all about the story and progressing and building something, isn't it? And even though Hamilton is no doubt in the twilight of his F1 career, perhaps there's still a massive story to be there about whether he can, you know, turn his W13 alongside the factory into a winner. You know, people still, you know, he's had the challenge of 2009, but people say it's always been him in the best car and whatnot. So I think that again is just to, you know, sort of tick every box, you know, shut up all the doubters as far as possible. I think, yeah, still what he can do on track is by basically saying what I was saying earlier, it's not to diminish the motivation he gets from what he does, you know, on a Friday, Saturday and Sunday at a racetrack.
One of the other conversations we had at the conceptual stage of commissioning this feature was that to what extent is Lewis now very motivated and aware of the fact that with the retirement of Sebastian Vettel, he is now the sole person willing to have these sorts of conversations and to use their profile to actually do something above and beyond driving a car very quickly on a Sunday afternoon and winning races. So, yeah, I think that's definitely a very, very important part of the mix. And for those of you guest joining us from the Autosport channel, if you are Autosport Plus subscribers, you will be able to read that feature very shortly. Elsewhere in the magazine this month, we've sent someone on location. We've actually come out from under our rock. We've sent a photographer somewhere. Oleg's got in his car and he's driven to Denmark. We've gone to Kevin Magnussen's hometown of Roskilde and run around there with Kevin himself. And what's fascinating about Kevin, he's not someone who sticks his neck above the parapet and talks about social issues, but he is someone who lives life his own way. And he's made his family home in Copenhagen rather than moving to some tax haven. Now, previously in his career, he has moved away. And generally speaking, it's coincided with him being booted out of Formula One. So maybe there's a bit of superstitiousness going on here. But he says he tried Dubai and hated it. He'd much rather be near family and friends. In fact, there was a time when it looked like his motor racing career was going to end, and his uncle made him get a job as a welder. So it's a very interesting feature. He actually takes us to his childhood home where he lived with his mother until he was a teenager. So very, very fascinating and revealing. And I don't know about you guys, Kevin's not someone who likes being interviewed, and in this one, he actually kind of came out of his shell a bit. He was a lot more relaxed.
A great interview. I love the fact that it's got so many personal touches in terms of it's not just it's not Oleg sitting down in some barren motorhome over a coffee, but actually, you know, with him in Denmark and going for a wander. And I love the fact that none of the locals stop him and ask for autographs. And the first people to do are French tourists who spot him and come over and say, hello, Mr. Magnuson. I mean, it's just great. You know, it's very, very authentic. Also, you know, it is interesting. There's a lot of drivers who live in Monaco or some other tax haven. I mean, Switzerland was the other popular one. You know, Jackie Stewart was there and obviously Michael and Alain Prost and so on. Dubai is another one. I have to say that I kind of understand why he wouldn't be that enthused with Dubai. It takes a lot out of you to get used to that that climate. And I mean that in the broadest sense, the whole climate that you have to live within down there. So good for him, you know, back home in Denmark. And obviously he must have structured things well enough that whatever he's earning from Formula One, you know, he's going to have a secure retirement. I think that Magnuson's story is a great one. You know, there's the father-son thing. There's the fact that he came in, you know, had his kind of false start, as it were, with McLaren and then obviously with Haas and then leaving and then coming back. And it's so much to it. It's a good story. And he's very authentic. And I think one of the things about there's drivers who don't mind doing interviews, but actually a lot of the drivers who don't mind doing interviews, I think in the end it becomes just a bit of a rote, you know, they say the same old things, you know, they've got a 20-minute patter that they'll give to any journalist on any range of topics. But so then when you get an interview like this where obviously Oleg wants to go a little bit deeper into the Magnuson story, but then Kevin having agreed to do it, he does it properly. He gives a real insight. He puts some meat on the bone about what makes him tick and the background to it and the family stories and the trials and tribulations of getting to where he's gotten to, the honesty of his relationship with Günther Steiner, you know, and you know, whether that's, you know, Günther telling him in very clear terms why there wasn't any future with him at Haas at that point and then bringing him back. So it's a really good, really good, authentic piece. I enjoyed it immensely and I think Oleg did a great job. And well done, Kevin, you know, because lots of drivers wouldn't make the time to do it properly like that. And I like that sort of level of commitment. So the readers will get a lot out of it.
Matt, of course, you've probably come across Kevin in the paddock here and there. Not someone who enjoys having a dictaphone thrust under his nose, but, you know, quite a fiery driver. I mean, where do you see him in terms of his value to Haas? Günther Steiner said he was basically the first person he thought of ringing when he decided that he was going to give Nikita Mazepin the flick at the beginning of the year.
At the moment, he's immensely important, isn't he? Because not only is he, you know, he's experienced, he can lead the development of that car, but whoever you put alongside him, whether it's Mick Schumacher or indeed getting rid of Mick Schumacher next to one, Magnuson's a good litmus test of where that driver is at and whether, you know, whether they're a benchmark and obviously his experienced hand, they can learn off him, whoever the new person is. Like you say, he doesn't give too much away from the media, but he was particularly good, obviously, when he first came back. So was at Bahrain pre-season testing and the first couple of races in sort of Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, where you had the journos coming to their first F1 event of the season. He was talking about, you know, how he got the phone call, how he, you know, retract or got out of his Peugeot sports car drive, how he came back in, the energy, and how, like, so to draw a comparison, I remember speaking to Jean-Eric Vergne saying he actually felt ready to leave F1 in some sense because he just couldn't get his head around going from karting and single seater series, going from, like, you know, wins and podiums to then being like happy with eighth or ninth. He just really couldn't grasp it and he found that really hard. Whereas Magnuson's the opposite. He's like, well, I can win in sports cars in America, which feels okay, but nothing compared to, you know, the elation of doing well in an F1 race, whether that is just for a point in the Haas as it has been this year. So I think he's come back and is completely at peace with where he's at, and, you know, it probably does him well to be the established team leader rather than that sort of, you know, him and Grosjean could sort of, Grosjean was probably the faster on his day, but more prone to crashing, and the competitive order used to fluctuate massively between them. But I think it's good, and he's got a better sense of where to F1 now, as in people appreciate him more now he's back. And again, probably after, you know, there's not much love lost for Mazepin, and they see how well he does against Schumacher, so there's an appreciation for him. And also, it's probably a good time to be an F1 driver in terms of signing those deals with Gillette or Lidl. Was it Lidl that Haas did, where they appeared in the pamphlet and Schumacher and Steiner were in some awful, like, Lederhosen or something? Because, but anyway,
very much so. Yeah. We gave them a little respect.
Absolutely. But the whole point is that commercially, you know, okay, you know, Magnussen might not be recognised, or he is recognised on the street. They just don't come and ask for selfies. But it's probably quite a good time to be an F1 driver and ride that wave of popularity if you want to sign a couple of, you know, aftershave deals and stuff just before you retire. But he's, you know, there's very few drivers now. I think F1's in a good place where, you know, if Latifi doesn't come back for next season because the points he's not scoring are worth more than the 15 to 20 million, you know, a season he does bring in sponsorship, Magnussen's not in that camp anymore. It's probably, you know, he's not considered a pay driver. So he brings value. And you know, through Schumacher's expensive crashes and a few other things, Haas are right up against it on the budget. And this season was all about bringing in a new car, developing it well after a couple of seasons out in the wilderness. They haven't done that now. So any extra, you know, anything they can find that brings them extra performance is a good thing. And I think Magnussen is probably one of those.
I think the little thing was chronicled partially in one of the episodes of Drive to Survive that focuses on them. I could be wrong, but it rings a bell. And it's quite strange, isn't it? Because Haas, for a team that has been largely stuck to the back of the grid certainly from the inception of that program, they do enjoy a substantial amount of airtime, principally because they're so open. And of course, Gunther has, a lexicon like a sewer, and he actually speaks, and they have a bit of character and they have a story, and so you can understand how that presence might feed into a little bit of commercial reward, as you say, with a lucrative Gillette sponsorship or something, whereas there are certain teams that do not appear in that program at all, just because either their drivers are uncooperative or there's not really much to them. I mean, there's a certain team in green at the moment that you don't see much at all, simply because their drivers don't cooperate, won't let Netflix come round to their houses. So I suppose in some ways, commercial reward does have a tangible link to the access you're prepared to give, you know, one of the most important TV programs. And I suppose we're coming up to our hour, but we can very, very briefly touch on what Ron Dennis would, no doubt in the past, of course, fiscal matters and commerce, because you know, we live in the era of the budget cap, agreed very, very painfully over a lot of negotiations. The level of that budget cap was a subject, not just the philosophy of having one in the first place, but the level it should be set at was, of course, as much existential angst. And the idea was that it was supposed to usher in a new era of competition on equal footing, help make the teams into billion-dollar franchises, enable these commercial connections. And yet now we have a situation where we're having to adjust it for inflation, and changing it so soon is pretty unprecedented. And Mark, in this month's issue, you've done the math, as they say in America, and basically unpicked a few of the arguments behind this sort of very hotly contested inflationary rage. You know, we do live in an era of spiraling cost of living. I sit here shivering as I speak to you in the coldest room of my house. So where is Formula One going if it's, you know, the editor of one of its biggest selling magazines is sitting in the coldest room of the house?
Well, you talk about the unprecedented nature of the budget cap being revised. It's because we live in unprecedented times, and there is no doubt that I'm sure it'll get revised again, I think, in some way, shape or form, or at least there will be discussions about what next. Because, first of all, let's talk about the things that have happened which were really unexpected. So the FIA and the teams sat down and agreed the budget cap based on a number of assumptions in terms of expenditure and budgets and what you could buy for that money and what you could do with that money. then President Putin decided to invade Ukraine, has sent energy costs spiraling, which has sent inflation spiraling because those energy costs are being passed on in all kinds of ways. Cost of manufacturing goods around the world, cost of shipping goods around the world, cost of flying goods around the world. I mean, everything. There's just a sort of compound effect. So the inflationary pressures have been extraordinary. And this means that individual members of Formula One staff and teams, they're facing, you know, unprecedented increase in costs at home. So inflationary pressures put pressure on salaries because people need more salary to cover those bills. I mean, in the UK, we know only too well about the energy crisis and the huge increase in costs that everyone's currently facing. And obviously the government hasn't fully tackled that yet. So there's lots of issues to do with that. But then is this in the inflationary pressures on the goods coming into a Formula One factory and all of the goods and services F1 teams are buying. So lots of inflationary pressures there. And those inflationary pressures are into double digits. You know, we're into double digit inflation. And that's something that was not expected. You know, we're talking about a world where for a long time we've been, there's been a target of kind of a couple of percent of inflation at most. And now we're into double digits. So it's off the scale. And quite naturally, that's putting pressure. And Toto, I mean, in the piece, I've quoted Toto Wolff talking about the fact that, for example, Mercedes want to look after their staff. They know that they're going to have to do something to tweak their salaries. There's going to have to be, I mean, whether it's one-off payments to deal with what's coming up this winter with, you know, the winter energy crisis that everyone's talking about. But essentially what we're talking about is there's a world of uncertainty out there. No one knows how long the war in Ukraine is going to last for. No one knows what Europe is going to suffer this winter. You know, because there's essentially not enough energy available. But the German government are asking if the whole country can find a way to reduce energy consumption by about 5% at the moment to just cope with the supply and demand requirements in the months ahead. So lots of pressure. It's led to particularly the larger teams that have had to come down in terms of their budget than pushing for the increase. You've got other people like Alpine. So Alpine were the one that weren't particularly keen on changing the budget cap. And the point I make in the piece is that Otmar Szafnauer, perhaps more than most, is used to being a team principal for a, you know, cash-strapped team. So Alpine's view is, well, we built in some inflationary pressure into our budget planning and we can cope with it. But the other nine teams were happy to have the increase. The increase in the budget cap is not that much. It's only a few percent. But one of the other factors is that the teams get paid sponsorship and their prize money in the United States dollar. So even if you've got teams based in the UK, Italy, and Switzerland, they're receiving a significant proportion of their income in the United States dollar. Not getting paid in pound sterling, not getting paid in euros, not getting paid in Swiss francs. At the time that we are recording this, you know, a single US dollar today will effectively get you 88 pence. You know, so, and for those listening who perhaps don't follow currency markets the way I do, if you go back just a year ago, we'd have, a single US dollar would have given you 70 pence. So you've gone from 70 pence to 87 pence. That's a huge increase. And what that means, I mean, in terms of, I mean, I put a figure on it in the article. It's worth about, so the money that you get, it's worth, in terms of the budget cap, it's worth about £7 million more of expenditure that you have in sterling in the UK. Now, what do you pay for in sterling? Well, you pay your salaries in sterling, so that's obviously a big chunk. You pay a lot of your travel in sterling if you're a UK based team. You pay for domestic supplies, you know, so any goods or services you're buying from the motorsport community in you know, Silicon Valley of motorsport here on the M40 corridor, you're paying for those in pounds sterling. So there's some upside on that. So there are some, you know, there's downsides and upsides, but it's a time of huge fluctuation. And the situation with the US dollar and the sterling, the pound sterling, and also the US dollar and the euro. So the euro and the US dollar have reached parity. So the US dollar is worth, you know, worth a euro. This is unprecedented. So there's a lot of talk at the moment that we're entering a sterling crisis and that the government's going to have to do something because that we are really out of balance to where we normally are at in terms of the currency valuations. And so really, this is my way of explaining. We're in the middle of uncharted territory in so many ways, and that's putting huge pressure on the teams, and therefore there's a requirement for the budget cap to have a degree of flexibility to cope with where we are now and what might happen in the future. So I think it's far from being the last time we'll be talking about this. There will continue to be pressures to revisit it. And I think such are the changes. We're not talking about small changes here. Such are these profound changes happening in currency markets and in the global economy that the FIA and the teams will not be able to just ignore it. They'll keep having to come back and revisiting it. So I think this is a story that will run and run until such time as war in Europe ends and the energy crisis dissipates. So could be, you know, how long's a piece of string? We don't know how long Putin is going to keep on at this particular strategy that he's deployed in Ukraine.
Yeah, seems to be he's not going to do one until he can do so gracefully. I'm not quite sure how he can make that sort of exit. Matt, obviously, we also have our own little bit of difficulty with inflation because, you know, we travel to Grand Prix, don't we? So that we've seen the effect of this inflation this year.
Absolutely, considering we face a similar problem in that we run the continent, so we spend in euros, and then we have to do our expenses system in pounds, which is then paid to us from converted into dollars and back into pounds again. So I have absolute sympathy for the money that they're not getting back. But it's interesting. I think it's good. It shows F1 and the FIA to be sort of fleet of foot in the circumstances to come back with this. But again, where it's going, there'll be more. But I still think the bigger fecal storm with the cost cap is coming, in the sense that we know that teams are breaking it, and how far you get down the road with. So if they're breaking it, and they were to, let's say, win a championship, maybe even a championship double, if they've spent dramatically over the cost cap, how do they get back from there? Because the FIA can't strip both titles, even though it's talked about sporting punishments, because that's such a terrible, terrible look. But obviously there'll be outrage from the others. So as Mark says, we're going to be coming back to the cost cap for this season, seasons down the line. You know, how it gets resolved will be fascinating to see, to use that lovely parlance. But, you know,
that well-worn cliche that people very often end features on, it'll be
absolutely
fascinating.
But, you know,
well, you know, one thing I'll say to you, Matt, is that the senior directors of every team are personally liable if there can be shown to be sort of malicious intent to overspend the budget cap. And that's, you know, if we were to get into that territory where the FIA are saying a particular team just decided to go for it and to keep throwing money at it and either try to hide that or actually not hide it and say, well, what are you going to do about it? Well, actually, the answer is the FIA could potentially, I mean, the rules are very clear. You could be banned. You know, you could be banned from working in F1. So, my goodness, you've just raised the prospect that we go into the winter with some dreadful budget cap explosion, you know, behind the scenes. Honestly, after what happened last year with Abu Dhabi, we really need to just finish this year's championship, have everyone smiling, have the awards, go into 2023. It'd be dreadful to think that we would then face a budget cap cluster.
So the yes. The resolution then could be what would the FIA do with Ferrari for its illegal oil burn? Just go, it's one sentence saying the matter has been resolved privately, and then just leave it
yes,
at that.
Exactly. We had a meeting. We all and it's completely confidential. But by the way, we've all got nice company cars.
the confidential settlement. You know, unlike the, you know, it's established practice that the first 5 minutes of the recording of this podcast has to end up on the cutting room floor because of numerous stinking legal minefields we deposit before we properly get going. I think our producer's going to have to go get his magic pair of scissors to the tail end of this podcast after he's stabbed me in the neck with his magic pair of scissors for going over the hour. So I think it is about time we all bid farewell. Thank the listeners for their tolerance for another episode of this absolute madness. If you want to take out a subscription to GP Racing Magazine, visit gpracing.com. If you want to buy a single issue, you can do so digitally very easily via Pocket Mags. Don't forget to also subscribe to Autosport Plus, those of you who are happily listening on the Autosport channel. And if you want to track down a paper copy, you can do so with our distributor's online tracker. Go to seymour.co.uk. That's Seymour spelled as in Springfield's favourite physician, Dr. Seymour Butts.co.uk. And you type in your postcode. It will tell you in the handy flip down chart where your nearest copy can be located. One more thing to say, thank you to my guests. Thank you, Mark Gallagher.
Thank you very much. Been great to be here. Speak to you next month.
Absolute pleasure. Where we will be discussing the curious case of Ferrari's 2022. And Matt Q, no doubt feeling the winter chill already in the frozen north.
It's after a lovely mild summer, it has dropped off noticeably. If you must know, I'm in a race against time. I'm away this weekend. I'm in a race against time to dry a sufficient number of pants before I go away. But I've already promised my girlfriend that we're not having the heating on, and I cannot back down from that. It's too much of a loss of face. So I don't know what I'll do at this rate. Soggy. I'll have a wet patch showing through my jeans, I think.
We're not in the territory of turning the radiators on to dry those pants, are we?
Too much of a loss of face. I've said no. 1st of November is when the heating comes on, and I'm not giving in from that. Mould can be painted over. Yeah, that's reasonable, isn't
it?
What? Well, when I come to power, it's heating on 1st of November. No Christmas ads before 1st of December. That's Q's Britain.
When I was in short trousers back in the 1980s, and I remember being bitterly cold one September evening in my bedroom doing my homework, probably because I was wearing short trousers. That was an inadvisable garb choice. And you know, I asked my mother to switch the heating on, and she said, yeah, nobody has their central heating on in September. Sorry, that's a terrible East Yorkshire accent. She didn't sound like that at all. But with that slightly Alan Bennett enunciation, we bring another episode of Flat Chat with Codders to a close. Thank you for listening, and thanks to our long-suffering producer, Martin Lee. We will see you next month.